difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Keith Phipps,
Tasha Robinson,
and Genevieve Kotsky.
On last week's show, we talked about Persona, Ingmar Bergman's radical 1966 drama about two women who bonded uncanny and disturbing ways while alone together in a seaside locale. This week, we're bringing in Edgar Wright's new film, Last Night in Soho, which pulls off a similar dynamic, but across a 55-year distance in time. Last Night in Soho stars Thomasin McKenzie as Ellie, a would-be fashion designer from rural Cornwall who's infatuated by the music and style of 60s London. She gets her chance to revive that style when she moves to London for fashion school, but she has trouble fitting in with her snootier classmates. One night, Ellie has a particularly vivid dream that transports her to the seductive world of the swinging 60s and introduces her to Sandy, an aspiring lounge singer played by Anya Taylor-Joy. Ellie has her hair colored blonde and starts designing a dress to match Sandy, but her fantasies take on a much darker quality when she returns to this dream world and discovers that Sandy has been forced down a very dark and violent path. Despite the many decades between them, past and present start to converge and have a major impact on Ellie's mortal and psychological well-being. We'll talk about Wright's elusive and disturbing thriller after the break.
Baby, you don't know what you say. What brings you down then?
I'm studying London College of Fashion.
Room is on the top floor.
It's perfect. I love it. If I could live any place and any time, I'd live here, in London, in the 60s. Last night, I saw something in my dreams.
And you are?
Sandy.
I got this kind of gift. I can see people, places, things others can't.
This is the closest most people ever get to their dreams.
Jack, I don't want to do this.
You think you can just walk away?
It really happened.
What did you see?
Do you believe in ghosts?
Okay, so I think we're noted Edgar Wright fans on this podcast. In fact, our one attempt so far at a commentary track was to the Edgar Wright film, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. So what do we think of this, the latest film by Edgar Wright?
I like this film. I was drawn into it and early on, and you know, I have a lot of interest in the same period that he's, you know, exploring, and which seems to come from an own personal obsession with the 60s on Wright's part in some ways, or at least deep interest in. I think we're going to, you know, not to get into it preemptively. I know a lot of people have level complaints about the second half of this movie. I think there are some issues in the second half, but I actually do like the second half of this film. But we can get into that a little bit more as other people weigh in.
I'm glad to hear you like it, because I haven't talked to anyone else who does,
really?
Which has made me feel a little bummed, because I also like this film while also acknowledging that it's probably my least favorite of Wright's films. Like, I don't really want to do that kind of ranking, but it does feel a little off model I don't even want to say that because it feels like it's he's like pushing himself with this film. And I respect that. And I think that he achieves it in a lot of ways. I think what I really respond to in general in Edgar Wright films is that they are very propulsive. They have a lot of forward motion, you know, like they are. I kind of alluded to this in the last episode, like they are just very narrative driven films, films like The World's End or Scott Pilgrim. Like there's actual like kind of checkpoints in the narrative, you know, like built into the narrative. It's a very kind of like I said, forward moving. And this one feels a little more kind of meandering, interior focused, you know, and that's the design of the film to a certain extent. You know, it's kind of moving back and forth in time, and it's in her head and also out of her head. And so it just feels a lot more unmoored, I think, than I'm used to. Like, I feel like with Edgar Wright films, like you kind of lock in for a ride. And this like did have elements of that, but it also felt like it was the ride got a little rocky, you know, along the way. So it wasn't like the smoothest Edgar Wright experience. That said, the first sequence when she goes into the 60s and sees Sandy for the first time, like took my breath away. It was like maybe one of my favorite things I've seen on film in a really long time. So I think just like the goodwill of that sequence kind of carried me through a lot of the remainder of the film. And I do see and understand people's complaints with the second half of the film and like the red herring of the Terrence Stamp character and that whole thing. Oh, spoiler alert. This is a spoiler podcast, but that character is a big old red herring. I get it. But again, I think like once I kind of got into the film's groove and was just really more riding the style vibe, that stuff didn't really bother me as much.
Yeah, I think the energy of this film's soundtrack is just so compelling and so much of a ride, you know, so it carries the emotions of the film so strongly. I had just a series of songs stuck in my head for literally weeks after watching this movie. I feel like Wright is just one of our best masters when it comes to putting an action sequence to music, like picking the right pop culture referential music that's like recognizable and instantly iconic to a sequence of action that it both enlivens and energizes. And so much of that happens here. You know, Ellie's experience is so tied to the music of the 60s and the iconography of the 60s. I feel like I've got probably some of the same quibbles that everybody has with the second half of the film, in part with some of the places that it goes, but in part just with some things that I feel like are relatively careless and shallow characterizations for characters that should matter more, that should be thought through more in this movie. But just as far as the first half goes, that opening sequence where Ellie, wearing a ball gown that she's constructed for herself out of newspaper, sings and dances alone in her home, kind of like putting on a little show for herself and for the camera and imagining her life to come, it's so compelling. I interviewed Edgar Wright for the movie, and I spent half of it just talking about the first dance sequence in the ballroom where Matt Smith is dancing with Sandy, and it keeps switching back and forth with Ellie. And most of that is a single shot done entirely with practical effects. There's only one place at the very beginning with a digital swap between the actresses where they just shot like Matt Smith dancing with each of them and match cut between them with a little digital cheat, apparently. The rest of it is just all, every time he passes one off screen, the other one just slips in smoothly. I just want to go back and revisit that scene over and over. There's so much deftness here, and there's so much life and light and color and energy. I think that there are flaws with the second half, but I think maybe one of the reasons we notice the flaws at all in the second half is just that, you know, disintegration and degradation and misery and murder and blood and hate is so much less fun than the joy of that first half, you know? Yeah. Scott's making his where is my beloved violence? Oh my God.
No, the thing, it's so regrettable because I'm agreeing with everything you say. Why? So upsetting.
I'm so sorry that you have to agree with me, Scott.
Oh, yes. The first half is so seductive and great. Dang, Tasha. Yeah, so I had that reaction. It was just, it was funny when, you know, I saw the trailer to this film and I thought, like, this is going to be the movie of the year. This is just, what an incredible trailer. This looks so exciting. And it's, plus it's, you know, kind of suggestive of, you know, certain film movements that I really, you know, like quite a bit. I was in an Edgar Wright.
Torture porn?
Huh? Yeah, like torture porn. And you know, it just in the color of it and the style and in the music, and I was so excited about it. And then kind of, you know, some of those, you know, middling reviews started sort of trickling in from the fall festivals. And I was like, how can this be so? And then, you know, I sit down and I watch the movie, and for the first hour, it's like, who are these idiots? Like, this film is incredible. What is wrong with them? And then the second half, I'm like, oh, okay, I kind of get it. I kind of see where this may have gone off the rails for folks, including myself, to a pretty decent degree. But it is really quite exciting while it lasts, and even when it isn't as good in the second half, there are still some elements of it to savor. I mean, I do. You know, you can be disappointed by the twists with regard to both the Terrence Stamp and the Diana Rigg characters, but still think those are great performances by people who have, you know, been around for that long and you know, and appreciate, you know, the amount of attention that Wright pays them, the amount of substance that is kind of given to those characters, even if, you know, there's a lot of things, I think, you know, wrong with film, a lot of missteps that are taken in that second half. But I was certainly won over by the first to a point where I can't imagine throwing this film out because there are obviously a lot of wonderful things about it. That sequence that Tasha, you know, and Edgar Wright kind of went over in great detail, being foremost among them. I mean, how can you just not be seduced by it? How can you not just be swept up in her excitement about it as well and get that kind of second hand high from it? So I did like it, and in a way, you know, I almost feel like my disappointment in the film sort of mirrored her disappointment in the era not being everything that she hoped it would be, everything that she idealized to be, even though normally when a film takes a turn toward the dark and murderous, I'm all the more excited to see that happen. It's just in this case, it goes along with a little more dubious plotting and a little bit more, you know, just dubiousness in general.
I'll admit here in front of everyone that I think one of my flaws as a critic is that if something wins me over early, I tend to be pretty forgiving of missteps later on. For me, the bad stretch of this movie is the sort of stretch where Eloise is falling apart, investigating the murder and kind of going mad. And I feel like it's repetitive and it's not particularly, it's not that scary, and it's not necessarily a very effective depiction of mental disintegration. And I hate the digital effects.
Yes.
Oh my God. I hate the ghosts. The ghosts in this movie are bad ghosts. Bad, yes. Ghosts. But I actually do really like maybe I'm corny, but I like the twists. Not so much the Stamp one is a little eye rolly, but the Diana Rigg reveal, it does pave the way for some great Diana Rigg acting and her swan song. And who could say no to that? But I also feel like the whole central idea of this film I found really resonant, because, you know, you have these relationships with the past through pop culture, and you have kind of a sense of like what an era is all about. And like, and then you go back there and you know, if you could travel back in time, like, you know, it would be pretty shitty then too. You know, it's there's shitty stuff going on no matter what era you're in, and perhaps in some ways even worse, because, you know, to be a woman in this era, to not be a white person in this era, this was a trickier place to be even than now.
Going back to the opening sequence that Tasha was talking about, which I also enjoyed quite a bit. I'm a sucker for a newspaper dress, man. But I also found it interesting how the film sort of reveals what it's doing as far as its timeline. Because correct me if I'm wrong, I did only see it once and I wasn't paying super close attention or tracking this when I watched. But I feel like you don't know that it's the current day until she leaves her home and we see her on the train or bus, I don't remember which, wearing a pair of Beats headphones.
Wearing Beats headphones. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Like, up until that point, it was like, oh, this is a period piece. You know, she's in the 60s, because, like, we only see her in the context of, you know, listening to these records and, you know, getting a letter in the mail that she's been accepted, a very, very thin letter. But
yeah,
I don't
know,
maybe they do things different
in the
but maybe it's different in London schools. But yeah, I just thought that was,
even stationery is expensive.
They send you a thick letter of apology when they for saying no. It's very British.
But
if you get no, you get a thousand howlers through your window along with a bunch of owls.
But yeah, I just thought that that was a very clever unfolding, I guess, of what the film is doing as far as its dual eras.
Yeah, I think that that's very deliberate, because there is something kind of timeless about Ellie, because she's so invested in the past. You know, she's so invested in past fashions and past music and past fantasies. I actually laughed when I saw the Beats headphones, because it just seemed so out of character for her, the version of her that we had established so far. But yeah, I didn't really have a clear association with what era she was meant to be in until that moment. And then, of course, it's done through product placement, which I just find, I still find that funny.
The film is actually fairly insightful about the experience of being a freshman in college, too, I thought. Mm-hmm. I thought, like, that was that's a fairly plausible roommate situation. Somebody
I don't know.
You don't think so?
I felt Jocasta was a little overblown as far as the nightmare, or it just felt like a very sort of pat nightmare roommate.
No, she is mezzo soprano, and Ellie is the roommate who completely loses her crap over the semester.
Yeah. I feel like, and obviously I think the film had to do this, but that relationship would take longer to get that gross, you know? She would take a while to reveal herself as being that horrible roommate, although maybe not. Things are different in London.
I don't know.
I think there's an interesting mix pretty early on between her deciding that Ellie's kind of a fuddy-duddy who's going to hold her back, and her being jealous. Like, even if the, like, showing off her connections and bragging in her thin-skinned way was a little over the top, where it's revealed that Ellie's mother committed suicide, and all the girls who are looking at her as a nerd kind of have their moment of, oh, you're so brave. And Jocasta just immediately bristles and has to come up with, like, I don't remember, like an uncle who had something bad happen to him or something once. Like, that actually rang fairly true to me. Like, I'm kind of over cinematic depictions of associations between girls being just all about, like, vipery competition and jealousy and meanness and judgment. But that one little moment of I'm losing them, I've got to come up with something myself, which was immediately responded to with that same kind of, oh, you're so brave. You know, it felt artificial, but it also felt funny and it felt real to me.
It felt heightened, but so much of this film is heightened that, like, it's not really a ding against it, I guess, but it just felt a little much. I don't know. I didn't respond well to the Jocasta of it all, but maybe that's just me not liking her.
Element of comedy that the film could have needed. I mean, that was one element that is present
true.
In Wright's films, but not as present here as in others. You know, I mean, there are some laps in that early section that are not there, obviously, when things get a lot more serious in the second half.
I think the problem, though, is because things get so serious in the second half, the kind of wingnut humor starts feeling kind of awkwardly wedged in. You know, you've got a movie that is fundamentally about the sexist institutions that destroy women's lives. You know, there's rape and there's exploitation and I'm not sure we want to get into the murder aspect of it yet, but, like, there's a lot of, like, horrible abuse going on in this movie. And it rhymes kind of weirdly with the silly Mean Girls comedy. You know, there are elements of this movie that I feel like Wright means for us to take seriously thematically. And it doesn't necessarily go well with like the candy colored musical fantasy or the kind of goofy humor in certain places. It jumps around tonally, maybe a little much for what the movie's trying to do.
And I also think that there's something amiss about the film's instinct to be about something in a pretty conscious way. I mean, you know, a lot of the films that Wright is referencing, you know, particularly the giallo films he's referencing, have a very, you know, exploitative perhaps, but also instinctual quality to them, that there doesn't seem like there's a huge amount of thought or calculation about what it all means or implies. And that's not the case here. This is a film that has some themes it needs to get into and some messages it needs to send, and it feels a bit incompatible to the style of film that he's trying to evoke, I think.
Yeah, and not to get too extra textual about it, but I did get that feeling too, Scott, and I'm tempted to kind of attribute it to saying earlier, you know, I think we're seeing Wright try to like push himself a bit into a new territory here. And one of like the biggest things against him as a director is, and a writer, is he doesn't do female protagonists. You know, like he's always, his films have always centered on men and had women sort of as secondary characters or accessories, you know.
Yeah.
And that's been a criticism of him. And so, you know, I think when this film was announced, it was notable that it was, you know, it had a female protagonist. And we should note that he co-wrote the screenplay with Christy Wilson Carnes. So this isn't like Edgar Wright writes a female character, but I think there is maybe a little desire maybe on his part to show that he can do something with a female character that is more meaningful than he has been perceived as being able to do with female characters in the past.
I also just want to jump back and say, like, I appreciate the ambition of trying to get a little more messaging into the giallo genre, particularly when it comes to, you know, those are very exploitative movies. Like, as you say, mm-hmm. they're kind of reflexive in what they're trying to get across with the, you know, skin and death. So trying to take that and make it into a story specifically about the exploitation of women strikes me as a strong and smart instinct. I feel like where this falls down is just in the second half, a lot of these characters feel very thinly characterized. That introduction of Ellie, as I say, is just so intense and clear. You know exactly who she is. The introduction of Sandy, it seems so intense and clear and just exactly who she is and what she wants. And then the story requires her to be forced into sex work, but it just doesn't feel like it takes the time to establish how she made those choices, how she fell down that slippery slope. It doesn't give her much agency. You know, we don't really get to see her making decisions. We just get to see her doing unsupportable things that she's just very clearly not profiting from. The promise is, if you sleep with all of these unattractive rich men, you'll be successful. Like, you'll get what you want. But we never get any hint that she's getting any of what she wants. We never get any hint of how we went from A to Z in this case. And in the same kind of way, Jocasta disappears and isn't really a character anymore, except for a small sort of gag at the end. Michael Ajao, who plays a man mm-hmm. who is in fashion school and is interested in Ellie, is exactly that kind of accessory love interest character that people complain about as far as his female characters go. Like, the man has no personality, no mm-hmm. agency. He has no believability. He's a dish rag who appears whenever Ellie needs him and has just no ability to advocate for himself or even respond to some pretty awful things happening to him. He's just a plot convenience. So, yeah. I mean, my big problem with the second act is mostly just how thinly characterized some of these people are and like the potentially like beneficial ideas of kind of examining giallo while doing giallo kind of get lost in the execution.
Yeah, and regarding John, the Michael Zhao character, I don't think you said he is the only Black character in this film. So if we're talking about someone who is in the role of a thinly drawn accessory, I think you have to take note of that as well. And I will say the scene where after the Halloween party, where they come back to Ellie's room and are getting it on in bed, and Ellie has a freak out and starts screaming, and Diana Riggs' character bursts in on them, and it looks really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks really bad for John in that moment. And I was extremely anxious during that whole interaction. But then it's not really addressed, you know? And obviously, I'm coming at it from a American perspective where Black men and white women having sex has a very fraught and upsetting history. And I don't know if that translates exactly to the UK, but it certainly was something that I brought into that scene and was very upset by and kind of dismayed that the film didn't really acknowledge or engage with.
Well, also specifically the idea of a Black man being accused of sexual assault of a white
right.
woman, and the idea that the police are going to get involved. Like, you're seeing something that literally destroy his entire life for mm-hmm. reasons that he not only is completely innocent of, but also just absolutely doesn't understand. She's responding to things that he can't see or hear. And as far as he knows, he went home with a consenting partner, and then suddenly she just completely freaked out on him. And the idea that the next time he sees her, he apologizes to her and wants to
yes.
go out with her again is just, it's so beyond the pale. It's not, it would be beyond the pale, like, even if there were no, like, racial or class dynamics involved in here. But given the dynamics that are involved, it's just like, this is not a character. This is a plot convenience.
I would actually be quite curious to hear from our UK listeners. There's so many of you, I'm sure, right? About their response to the racial dynamics of this, because it is, in America, very charged. It felt to me like a bit of colorblind casting that backfired horribly on, mm-hmm. on the film, in my opinion. And I think that's kind of maybe true of the other aspects of it, of Wright trying to understand women and sexual violence better, to address some of the blind spots that people might have noted about his filmography, but then those attempts to address it also being very flawed, and him being not as assured in that as he is in subject matter that is more in character types that are more in his wheelhouse.
I mean, a fair deal of this does fall to Christy Wilson-Cairns, who is, by the way, the screenwriter of Dunkirk, which is a very written movie, a very mm-hmm. Constructed movie in a very interesting way.
Mm-hmm. A very masculine movie, too.
A very masculine movie. And, you know, I've seen interviews with her talking about Last Night in Soho, and I definitely think that a lot of this does come from her. Edgar Wright talks about how, like, this was all a kind of vague idea with a soundtrack, a playlist that he had built up for quite a long time that was kind of a lesson in anti-nostalgia. But it sounds like she came in and gave it a lot of its structure and a lot of its characterization. So I really don't want to, we have no idea how they worked together exactly. I definitely don't want to put mm-hmm. too much mm-hmm. of this in the lap of, like, Edgar Wright has a problem writing women, or Edgar Wright doesn't understand sexual assault. Like, anything that we're saying in that vein, I think both, you know, deprives his writing partner of her agency and involvement, and is like blaming him for things we have no idea whether he did.
And her, right, and her faults for screwing up this part of the movie.
Dang.
But, you know, one thing I would say, anti-nostalgia is a very important theme that I did not, that I guess hasn't been mentioned, but I think is such an important part of the movie, and what does kind of give it distinction, at least that gesture of just like of really idealizing the past to a point where you just forget what that past has teeth to it, you know, and that a lot of the things that you might imagine are wonderful about that a certain era, you know, are in fact, you know, colored by a lot of things that are very, very bad. You know, I think about like that Stephen King book 11/22/63 and how much, you know, and just generally how much he loves to indulge in certain periods of American life it takes him kind of an effort every once in a while to remember, oh, okay, then there was, you know, there were segregated spaces. You know, you kind of have to point that stuff out because you can get lost in the things that you really love about the past because you didn't live there. You didn't live there during that period, and you are of a certain color, you know, and you are male. Maybe you forget. So I do like the fact that the film is so in love with the swinging 60s, so in love with the music, so in love with the films of that era, but does have that ability to kind of step back and say, well, it wasn't really all that great, that there were these other aspects to it that were hidden or that we forget.
And that's also just a really big theme for Edgar Wright. I mean, the villains in Hot Fuzz are essentially a bunch of people who have an idealized version of the past that they're trying to maintain at the cost of people's lives, at the cost of people's freedom and humanity. The World's End is fundamentally about somebody who is stuck in a past that nobody else remembers fondly in the way that he does. So this is... it's a really interesting idea for Wright, given his own obsession with the past. He gave the cast and crew on this movie a list of 50 movies to potentially go watch to understand where he was coming from on this. You know, he is a musical historian. He's a film historian. He's in love with the past himself. But he keeps making these movies that kind of consciously say, like, if you're living in the past, you're living wrong. If you're pretending that the past was better than it was, you can't move forward. I just think he's very aware of this tendency that he has, and he keeps, you know, consciously writing against it.
So I actually enjoy, and this is heavy spoiler territory here. So, but I mentioned that I actually do like the final twist of this movie, which is, to me, it's like kind of a neat little, I think I likened it in my review for the reveal to like a Alfred Hitchcock Presents twist or something like that, like sort of a neat little short story twist where you find out what's been going on. I think other people are not quite as on board with that at all. I think I like it as a clever ending. I wonder though how we want to, you know, how it makes us think of Sandy, though, whether or not we see the enough continuity between the character of Sandy that we see on screen in the 60s and then the character played by Diana Rigg later on.
I mean, I think it's one of those reveals that kind of asks you to go back and change your reading of everything that you already saw and already processed a certain way. And I think to one viewer, that's clever, and to another viewer, that's a cheat and cheap, you know? I think the scene where we actually see Sandy in the past, quote unquote, get stabbed by the Matt Smith character and see all the blood, I think that is a tough one to just reconcile stylistically, formally, or whatever, with this twist, because it kind of just asks you to re-envision the physics of that whole moment, or it seems like you've been lied to. So I don't know. I kind of want to. I would want to go back and actually watch that scene and watch how it's replayed with the twist and like see if it works better than I think it did. But I suspect that is maybe kind of the crux of a lot of people not buying that twist, is how we see that moment happen in flashback versus how it happens in the reveal.
You know, it's almost like sometimes movies have big disjuncts in them that show you kind of one version of a story and then shift to show you kind of a different perspective or a different part of a story. And maybe that's part of what the filmmaker is deliberately doing. Can anybody think of any other films like that?
Maybe all cinema is just a lie anyway. Maybe we shouldn't trust anything.
I don't really know. I don't know what Tasha you're referring to, but it's possible that we may bump into this.
Ooh.
When we come back after the break to talk about the connections between Persona and Last Night in Soho.
Least I can do is drive you home.
Ah, what's the most?
Well.
Do you know Goose Street?
Very well.
I'm on Goose Place, number 8.
Madame? With all these lights shining on you,
It's the closest most people ever get to being on stage. You know, to their dreams.
Not me.
Not you. I could see you want it.
More than anything.
Well, this is just a taste of things to come, Sandy.
Now it's time for connections when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. And, you know, one thing they have in common are two different people who kind of merge, Genevieve.
Yeah. Yeah, the connection as you have it written in our script is doppelgangland, which I will not, that is a Scottism that I will not take credit for. But yeah, I mean, we are talking about two films that have two characters that are presented as doppelgangers to a certain extent. They're doubles. In Last Night in Soho, it's a little more that Ellie is willingly taking on the identity of Sandy after seeing her in the first vision, whereas in Persona, we're kind of presented, the women are a little more of a paired conceit right from the beginning, I think. Like, we're told that they look alike, kind of, right from the jump. We already talked in the first half about how maybe they don't actually look that much alike. But I mean, you know, without parsing the nuances of like how much these characters slash actresses look like each other, like both films were specifically cast with two women who are reflections of each other visually to a certain extent. And mirrors are obviously a very big motif in both films as well. So in both cases, the doubling of these two women is ultimately less about the visual of how they look when they share a frame, although both directors very much like to find interesting ways for them to share a frame. But it's more about the thematic connection and the shifting identities between these two maybe halves of the same persona, if you will.
One thing that I was thinking about when you're talking about mirrors is that I think that one difference here is that with One Night in Soho, it's kind of a one-way mirror, really. It's not like mm-hmm. The two are interacting. It is really just Ellie who is experiencing, you know, Sandy's world and not the other way around. Whereas in Persona, there is an interaction and then a convergence and kind of a mixing of identities to some degree. So it's a little more active and a little bit more two-way, even though the women do, you know, contrast in pretty important ways too. So I mean, I guess that would be kind of a difference between them. But
I mean, we do see, like I said, we do see Ellie kind of like taking on the identity of Sandy, that, and that feels sort of reminiscent of what we were talking about in the first half about Elizabeth's maybe sort of siphoning Alma's, you know, identity to a certain extent as well.
Taking her stories, taking everything in that's being shared with her in a very, well, vampiric way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, Alma steals from Elizabeth too. She literally steals her husband. There's that.
Is it literally though? Or is that a dream sequence?
The way that I most want to read that is that there's an outside perspective on the two of them for maybe only the second time in the movie. And that outside perspective says that Elizabeth doesn't actually exist, that Alma is the real one there. And Elizabeth is kind of a persona, if you will, a silent witness to what's going on between Alma and her husband, who has feelings and thoughts about their relationship that she can't express. That's how I read that sequence personally, as opposed to it being a dream. Does that fit with all of the other pieces? Not necessarily, no, but I've commented on that already. My point is mostly just like Alma is certainly as guilty of stealing things from Elizabeth in the back and forth between them. But yeah, I do think it's very significant that Ellie has these visions and so immediately throws herself into them. I mean, as much as I love the back and forth dance sequence and the opening number, one of my favorite things in the movie is just her enthusiastically putting on her record and throwing herself into bed that second night because she can't wait to get back to her like weird magical body swap dream things that she's having. Like, she's excited. They're exciting. They're simpler and more compelling than the life that she's actually living. And she just really wants to be back in that fantasy again. So, you know, no wonder she dyes her hair and buys clothing to look more like Sandy and just tries to live out this fantasy that she's having.
Yeah, I do find it interesting to think about Ellie's relationship to Sandy in the context that we were talking about Elizabeth and Alma in terms of like who is like taking from who and who is, you know, sort of like the vampire, I guess, if we want to continue with that theme, because Ellie is obviously telegraphed as so much more the innocent, the naive, you know, she's dancing around and throwing herself into bed. And she's just like, you know, well, they're both wide-eyed characters physically, but, you know, she is just telegraphs as a much more sweet and innocent presence. But, you know, she is kind of drawing her identity as an artist, as a fashion student from Sandy. And I think I come back to I believe it's the very last shot of the movie after Ellie's successful fashion show. And we have another mirror moment of her seeing Sandy and doing a little like nose boop, you know, and it's a very assured and vaguely sinister. I felt it was vaguely sinister in that moment. It felt a little bit like Ellie had taken on something a little dark, you know, in her connection to Sandy. Did anyone else feel that?
Yeah, she'd sort of stolen Sandy's essence, and meanwhile Sandy had allowed herself to be set on fire. She's gone now. So whatever presence she had in the world is now, you know, entirely owned, or at least whatever part of her, you know, Ellie wants to own is now hers to take. And I kind of appreciated that little dark note incidentally, because I felt like the denouement was maybe the low point of the whole movie for me of Last Night in Soho. And so I kind of liked that that what seemed like kind of a weird happy ending ended up having just a little bit of an edge to it at the end. It kind of helped salvage that scene a little bit for me.
You know, much more than anything that happens in Persona being possibly a fantasy or possibly a dream, I have a much harder time accepting somebody deciding to commit suicide by sitting down in a room that's on fire, like, and then just like placidly allowing themselves to be consumed by fire. It just absolutely does not work for me. You know, here is a story that has ghosts and time travel in it, and the thing that is implausible for me is just somebody's response to fire. But
it is a connection to Persona, though. You're burning alive in each of them.
It is true, but I mean, if you've ever watched a video of somebody setting themselves on fire for a protest, it does not. It's not often peaceful. It's a horrible, horrible thing. I was going to bring that in, but I thought it was going to be too tactless. So I'm glad somebody else did it.
Oh, no, that's me. Leave that to me.
I will say that, I think in terms of that whole, like, who's taking from who thing, I think it's very significant that both Ellie and Alma are hungry, that there's something huge missing in their life that they want. And Alma articulates it. You know, she comes out and says to Elizabeth, like, nobody ever listens to me. I didn't realize how much I wanted somebody to listen to me. I never realized how wonderful it is to talk. Like, she, as I said before, kind of projects this image of what she needs on Elizabeth and turns her into that. But Ellie does the same thing with Sandy. She sees this image that's the image Sandy is trying to project. And she accepts it as the reality and hungers for it and wants it and takes it on herself. She gives into the fantasy. In this case, it is something that Sandy's aware of and trying to do herself. But in both cases, you have a woman who's missing something in their life and seems to see it in this other woman and kind of takes it for themselves, potentially with disastrous results.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one thing I would add is I think you really just probably gotten it here, which is that it does feel a little bit like Alma and Ellie are on a similar trajectory with regard to their relationship to the other woman and how it also shifts, you know, at a certain point too. I mean, really at that halfway point, I mean, there's this kind of almost very sharp line of demarcation where this fantasy of what that other person means it does start to fall apart, and you end up with it in a much, much, much darker place very, very quickly. But there's a lot here too, I think, Tasha, about the relationships between women, which of course is obviously very important to both films.
Yeah, I did say earlier that the whole business between Ellie and Jocasta just kind of takes me to a place of, here we are again. Women can't have friendships. They can only have like catty enmities where they semi get along, but they're in competition with each other, which is just like one of the big lies of cinema. You know, it's more exciting than close supportive friendships. And it heads back into a long, long era of films being mostly written and directed and produced by men. So there's not a lot of believable female friendship in earlier movies. But here we have just a very clear model of not a catty mean girls kind of relationship and not an immature schoolgirl cutting each other down relationship in Persona, but like adult women who are aware of the holes in their lives and are using each other, trying to fill this in. Because Elizabeth is just as hungry and just as needy as Alma is, and to some extent is using her in the same sort of way that Alma appears to be using her. With Sandy and Ellie, that relationship, I think, is less schoolgirl competition and more a kind of a deep understanding of each other. It just takes them a while to get there. And then Ellie has to pull back from it because it becomes a survival tactic. But I think both of these movies just have very interesting and thoughtful spins on kind of the usual insecurity, like jealousy, cattiness based relationships that women so often have, especially young women in film.
Well, and Ellie, as the film progresses, takes on a sort of, I guess, protective feeling towards Sandy when she starts playing detective. And I feel like Ellie's relationship to Sandy kind of has a weird arc, because initially she is so drawn to her because Sandy is so much that Ellie is not. You know, she is an extrovert. She lights up a room. She is comfortable in social situations, all things we have seen Ellie struggling with. She's a popular girl. She's a cool girl, whatever, you know. So there's definitely, you know, if you want to put this in high school friendship terms, you know, she's the popular girl and Ellie is the new girl who is drawn to her. But, you know, as Ellie's idea about Sandy shifts and what she, you know, learns about Sandy's life or perceives about Sandy's life shifts, like I said, she becomes kind of like protective of her and maybe less admiring. And that goes into what we were talking about as far as the sort of nostalgia themes of here. You know, her eyes are open, or the scales fall off her eyes, however you want to put it, in regards to Sandy, but she still, I think, feels that connection because of she saw in Sandy what she wanted to see in herself from the beginning, and she can't really let go of that.
So this is these are allusive films, Last Night in Soho and Persona, right, Keith?
Is Persona, though? I think that's the thing. We talked about so many films that draw on Persona. It's not exactly without precedent. I mean, I think there are a lot of, you know, Bergman has influences. I mean, Dreyer being a very, very strong one. Scott knows all about Carl Dreyer.
And Lucien Andalou, you said we talked about earlier.
Right, exactly. There's that as well. But it's one of those things where it's kind of influenced so much, it's kind of tough to see where it came from in some ways. Whereas Edgar Wright is very much a filmmaker who freely and openly and to the point where it becomes part of the style, it brings in his influence of the filmmakers he loves and the films he loves as well. So it's kind of a, you know, to me, it's almost more of a point of contrast than something they have in common.
Edgar Wright, I feel, always talks about what films influenced each of his films. Like, I feel like that's kind of standard in his promotion cycle for every new film. And he certainly did it for this as well. I think it was at IndieWire. He talked about the, like,
For IndieWire, he actually did a list of 25 films. Right. That helped influence this film and explained each one of them.
And none of them were Persona, though, right?
Yeah,
no, but Persona is
number 25.
Oh, number 25.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, but it is included on his. He did he also did a list of films that influenced it for Criterion, which I will talk about a little bit in our your next picture show segment down the line. But that was Persona's included among those.
Okay. Well, I stand corrected. But
I feel good about our choice to pair these two movies.
Oh yeah, no. Yes, obviously it's right there. I wanted to bring it up in the context of a connection about style, because there was a kind of a stylistic beat between the two films that felt very purposeful, but also maybe a little less than obvious, which is sort of the aural / visual cue leading you into a dream sequence. One of the coolest things, I think, in Last Night in Soho visually is that light of the French restaurant outside her apartment. that is, and obviously that gives us a very cool giallo-y palette, but it also is, along with the music, sort of it's the cue that enters her into this sort of dreamscape. And there's only a little bit of that in Persona, but it's such a pivot. It's at such a pivotal moment, which is the mirror moment where Elizabeth maybe visits Alma's room in the middle of the night, and they look at each other / us in a mirror. And immediately preceding that, there is a foghorn outside, or we hear a foghorn, and there the light of the film kind of changes, and there's just this very kind of specific drop into a new headspace, I guess, for the film. And I would not be surprised. I didn't read the Persona blurb, obviously. Wright wrote, so maybe he brought that up, but I liked that detail.
For sure. Those, that list of influences for Wright is so fun to get through, because if you the ones that I had seen, I mean, plenty of them I hadn't, but the ones I had seen, you could see how they reflected both the Argento and the H.G. Clouseau Inferno are both seem like they're referenced in this movie. So that was kind of funny. And, again, just being able to, it's Suspiria you see a lot of in the film. Of Peeping Tom, I think, is a good example of a film that influenced Last Night in Soho that almost feels also relevant to Persona. I mean, obviously it came later than, did it come later than Persona? Peeping Tom would have been earlier than Persona, wouldn't it have been?
Peeping Tom is earlier than Persona, yeah.
I'll be damned. But yeah, because it's that association, quite literal association of film with violence. I mean, with Peeping Tom, of course, you have the camera being this quite literal assaultive object of there being this blade on the stand itself, in addition to the camera being this aggressive voyeuristic presence. And so I think that both Wright and Bergman are kind of speaking in the language of film as a potentially violent and aggressive tool that can be used in one way or the other. They don't necessarily use them for the exact same ends, but that association is there.
I just think it's significant with Last Night in Soho that it's a movie about reaching back to the past and expecting some specific things there and finding something completely different there instead. So it just seems appropriate that he would bring in so many different allusions to the past. The IndieWire list I thought was really interesting, in part because, there are some very literal quotes in this movie. The repulsion scene of the protagonist stumbling through a forest of arms grabbing at her comes to mind. But a lot of the movies that he's quoting are essentially just, here's something that I looked at for how people actually dressed in the 1960s. Here's a movie that's not great in and of itself, but is interesting because it was so low budget that they were just wearing their clothes instead of costumes. So we went back and looked at that to see how the dresses should move and flow. Sometimes Quentin Tarantino in particular, who's another just infamous crate digger when it comes to his cinematic references. Sometimes he feels just a little too much of a copycat to me in terms of, let's just do this thing that somebody else did. But with Edgar Wright, I always feel like things are recontextualized in different and interesting ways. So in our last conversation, when we were talking about Persona, using shots from Unchained Andalou, and I asked Keith, well, is that the only reference? Because it's really interesting. I went and looked it up. And those little snippets that are, you know, look like old silent movies with a guy running around being chased by skeletons, actually from an earlier Bergman film. He's just he's referencing himself. Hmm. He's cannibalizing himself. But again.
But he made those were not, he did not, he was not part
no,
of the
No, 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 no. It's,
like
it's from a 1949 movie that he did called Prison or The Devil's Wanton, depending on which translation you use, that's about somebody making a film, trying to create the best film in history. I haven't seen this movie, so I don't know. But apparently he made those shots himself. He's not drawing from the silent era. He's drawing from himself, like recreating the silent era, which I just think is a fun little bit of illusion.
Mining from your own obscurities. That seems like a good strategy. Rather than just taking shots from Summers with Monica or something. Yeah, if we want to talk about the many layers of allusion and theme and style in these movies, we could be here all night and or whenever it is you're listening to this podcast. So we'll stop there. Last Night in Soho is currently in theaters. Persona is streaming on the Criterion Channel and on HBO Max, and it can be rented on Apple TV and Amazon. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time for your next picture show, where we recommend films or film-related items that we think our listeners might enjoy. What have you got for us this week, Keith?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, Edgar Wright has a kind of a playlist up on Criterion with nice little introductions where he talks to Alicia Malone about his life and movie going and some of the movies that he
Adventures
has.
In movie, Adventures in movie going?
That's correct. That's mm-hmm. correct. Adventures in movie going. And among the, we was a film we came very close to actually doing on the show, which was Blood and Black Lace, because, you know, in the run up to this, and it would be obvious even if he were talking about it, but Wright's talked about giallo being an influence, the Italian sort of thriller subgenre, and he chose this particular film by Mario Bava, both because it is a good giallo film, but also because it has a particular influence on Last Night in Soho. That's called, which is Blood Black Lace, was released in 1964, just a year after The Girl Who Knew Too Much, which was Bava's first giallo film and pretty much the first giallo film. As its name suggests, it's a Hitchcock-inspired film. And I think with Blood and Black Lace, he kind of sort of started to push giallo in more the direction we know it. We have like these really lurid colors, a like semi-nonsensical plot at the center of it, a masked killer, just, you know, and sort of a more explicit approach to sexuality, somewhat exploitative, but in a way that kind of, you know, it's an influence on Last Night in Soho in the sense that it is an exploitative film that's also understands that there's some sort of critique to be offered on exploitation at the same time. It's quite good. I think we would have had a good time talking about it. It doesn't give you as much to talk about as Persona, because I don't think any film gives you as much to talk about as Persona. But I would definitely recommend that for those curious about where Last Night in Soho came from, where giallo came from, or just kind of just want to check out a very lurid and exciting thriller.
I've not seen that film, Keith. I've the only Bava I've seen is Black Sunday.
I've seen a lot of Bava, actually, but I had not seen that one until I just watched it because of this film. And, you know, if you can't see this at listening at home, but there's a poster, a Spanish poster for a reissue of Bava's Planet of the Vampires behind me as I record this, which was a big influence on Alien. You know, he's quite the influential director, and a lot of his stuff's, I mean, you know, we kind of point to, we're talking about, you know, talking about giallo, we're talking about a film that film is Alien. You don't really have the slasher film without his 1971 film A Bay of Blood, also known by the much cooler name twitch of the death nerve. So yeah, if you're curious about Baba, it's really worth, it's really fun stuff to dig into. Genevieve, how about you?
Well, with apologies once again to Scott, I am going to recommend not a movie, but it is so close to a movie in multiple ways, not to mention connected to one of our films here. So I feel good about recommending Scenes from a Marriage 2021. This is the new-ish HBO adaptation of Ingmar Bergman's 1973 miniseries, also called Scenes from a Marriage, which also starred Liv Ullmann. So, you know, do you approve, Scott? Can I bring this TV show into our film recommendations?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay,
good. It's a film-related item.
It is a film-related item, so yes.
And the original was both film and TV
that's
show.
That's true. Yeah. This version, I feel, is very solidly a TV show. It stars Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain as the couple at the center of the titular marriage, which sort of famous, I don't think it's a spoiler, if you have any familiarity with the original, sort of famously devolves. I think, yes. I admit that I have been going through this 5-episode series very, very slowly. It premiered back in September, just weeks before I got married, so it did not seem like the most thematically appropriate watch for various reasons, but you know, I've gotten over that, and it definitely was one that I knew I needed to catch up on for this year, and I'm glad I did. It is definitely, you know, what you might call a difficult watch. These are, you know, not easily likable characters, and their relationship is a thorny one in several respects. This version notably kind of flips the power dynamic of the husband and wife. Jessica Chastain plays a sort of high-powered tech CEO type, and Oscar Isaac's character is a professor who has more of a laid-back, stay-at-home dad kind of vibe. And that informs their relationship in ways that are markedly different from the original. There's also sort of a wraparound conceit involving like pandemic filming that is like kind of weird, and I'm not sure it works, but it does feel kind of reminiscent of the sort of self-reflexive stuff that we saw that we talked about with Persona. But really, I think the appeal here is 100% Isaac and Chastain, who are both very good performers, who have very good chemistry together. They have played a couple before in A Most Violent Year. They're friends going back like 20 years. They just have a whole lot of history and chemistry and talent to draw on here. And they convey intimacy in a really remarkable way. So if those are performers you like, you know, I think that's reason enough to see this, but with the caveat that like it is not necessarily an easy watch or a fun watch, or definitely not a romantic watch, but it is a very well done, well executed series. So I would recommend checking out Scenes from a Marriage.
See, I'm not thinking about other, like, you know, films that you might recommend at certain points of your life. I'm just like, well, I'm going to recommend Kramer versus Kramer and Marriage Story, and we're just going to be very concerned about how things are going. But anyway, but I do want to see this. It's one of those things where it's like, yeah, I'll totally catch up with that. I promise. Anyway, who knows?
Yeah, you know, just it gives you stuff to look out for, stuff to watch out for as a newlywed. That's all.
Yeah.
So, Scott, what about you?
Yeah, I would like to recommend the new Pablo Larraín film, Spencer, starring Kristen Stewart, which has really kind of grown on me since I saw it and wrote about it. It's one of those things. It's one of the things about kind of getting back into reviewing a lot of major films is just remembering how much the process of writing about a film it just clarifies your thoughts on it, and I felt a lot more warmly the film writing about it than I necessarily did right off the bat watching it. But in any case, this is very much a companion piece to Jackie, his film about Jackie Kennedy. You know, also this is about Princess Diana. It, like Jackie, takes place over a very small time period. This film is just, Christmas weekend, 1991. It's got a lot of stylistic signatures that are similar, kind of the, you know, it's got a very spare instrumental score. This is by Johnny Greenwood. The last one was Mika Levi. There is, you know, the framing of the film. There's a lot of like long shots, so a lot of use of telephoto lens. There's just a lot of similarities between the two films. And of course, the films are also about very public women and fashion icons, I suppose, who are under a tremendous amount of scrutiny and pressure and have to wriggle their way free from that or try to figure out how to deal with that pressure. And so, you know, where we catch Diana as Spencer opens is her being in a very, very bad place in her marriage and her relationship with the royal family and feeling a little bit rebellious in a way that deepens a lot of those tensions. You know, so she's arriving at this, you know, at this estate for Christmas, and there's a lot of these traditions that she's having to follow. She has to weigh herself, which is something they're supposed to do for a bit of fun, because at the end of the weekend you'll have eaten a lot of food and so you'll weigh more. Fun British stuff like that. And you know, she's supposed to wear, you know, a certain dress. She's got all of her dresses picked out for her for each day of the week, and not each day of the week, but each meal that she goes to, each occasion that she goes to, she has a different outfit picked out for her. And there's no part of her day that isn't planned. But meanwhile, she's extremely unhappy in her marriage. She is clearly full of regret for the life that she's taken on, and is the home's the estate's location near her actual birthplace is causing her a certain amount of distress and regret as well. And it's a film that just kind of gets into these hidden tensions and, you know, high anxiety of this woman, kind of woman on the verge of a nervous breakdown, to quote the Almodovar title. And it's all very beautifully wrought, and it has this central performance by Kristen Stewart that is incredible. Like it's something where you think like, okay, you've got an American actress and she's going to play Princess Diana, and she's Kristen Stewart, who is so, you don't expect her to disappear into a role like that, but she does so instantly. It's stunning how thoroughly she is immersed in this character, and then you get so many great performances around her, including from a couple of really great performances by Mike Lee favorites like Sally Hawkins and by Timothy Spall as well. Timothy Spall plays, you know, a character who kind of is, you know, is sort of there to kind of keep things moving along, but his interactions with her are very much from a position of someone representing the royals, and a lot of the things that he's suggesting that she do at certain moments is just laced with a very subtle hostility that we feel and she feels very, you know, intensely. So very impressive film, very much a companion piece with Jackie. If you like Jackie, then I certainly would recommend seeing. If you didn't like Jackie, then maybe I would give it a miss. But Spencer, it's out now in a limited way. Maybe it will find its way to you, but it's worth seeing for sure.
Without spoiling anything, do things work out for her?
Wow, that's a dark question. It's a few years yet. You know, it takes a little while before things really don't work out. But this is not a great time. Not a great 91. 10 years. They're 10 years into the marriage, and things are going. She loves her kids, you know, and they love her back. Yeah. And that's a very powerful part of the film. So, Tasha, how about you?
So, someone sent me a trailer and said, check this film out. And I started watching the trailer and thought to myself, okay, that's interesting. There's clearly a lost animated movie from roughly 1982 that I've never seen before. It's called The Spine of Night, and it is, in fact, a movie made in 2021. Although, if you watch it, or really, if you watch any clip of it, watch the trailer, you will think that you're watching something from the era of like the height of Ralph Bakshi and heavy metal. The Spine of Night is just a hardcore throwback movie to an era of not just rotoscoping, which it has that kind of like loose fluid movement of cell painting over actual human bodies, but just a specific kind of adult animated filmmaking. One of the main characters is a a witch woman from the wilds who runs around pretty much stark naked through the whole movie. And she is not the typical kind of body that you normally see as somebody who somebody decided to leave naked for the whole movie in an exploitation flick. There's just a lot of interesting choices on display in this movie. And a lot of interesting voices, including Lucy Lawless and Patton Oswalt, Richard E. Grant, Betty Gabriel, Larry Fessenden as the Prophet of Doom. This is definitely the kind of movie that has characters named the Prophet of Doom and Gal Sur and the Guardian. It's a real, real old, like, dime paper novel, Robert E. Howard / Michael Moorcock kind of thing. It stretches on for literal centuries. Anybody who's seen Heavy Metal, it's not an anthology like Heavy Metal, but it does kind of have that sense of there's cosmic magical power, and it is enduring, and it confers a kind of horrible immortality, and death does not mean anything in this sword and sorcery world. So it's pretty heady, which is to say it's a head film, which is to say it feels like it was made for people who love heavy metal music and various kinds of mood-alterating substances. But I found it pretty fascinating as an artifact, just the idea that people would want to make a movie that looks like posters that a certain kind of metalhead from the 1980s would have had on their walls in this day and age. It's definitely not a perfect movie. It has all of the flaws of a Ralph Bakshi movie of the era or heavy metal, except for the fact where it doesn't have a character spend like 20 minutes taking a bath and thus miss out on protecting the people that she's been called to protect in combat. If anything, it mocks that mentality a little. It was definitely self-aware of both its audience and its era, but the filmmakers aren't mocking that era either. There's a real burning sincerity to this movie, like a real thorough and non-sarcastic love of a particular kind of dark epic fantasy and a particular kind of mentality. And it's a fascinating movie. It's available on streaming now. You can rent it in all of the usual digital places. And if the fact that there's only one heavy metal in the world was not enough for you up until now, if Rock and Rule did not quite scratch the itch for another movie in that vein, The Spine of Night, it's sitting there waiting for you.
Wow. Yeah, that seems like a pretty... I had seen a lot of back and forth about that one, because of Patton's involvement in it, but the look of it, it definitely looks like a movie out of time. Definitely does not look like a movie from 2021, which to me sounds kind of great. And probably appropriate to this episode in which we talk about a film that deals with nostalgia. But that is it for this edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next pairing is November 23rd and 30th. Keith, what do we have on tap?
In the first half of our next pairing, we'll be discussing Passing, the directorial debut of Rebecca Hall, starring Ruth Negga and Tess Thompson, an adaptation of Harlem Renaissance novelist Nella Larsen's 1929 novel of the same name. It's the story of two childhood friends who reunite in adulthood after one has married a racist white man unaware of her past. Looking around for a possible pairing, we were inspired by RogerEbert.com critic Odie Henderson's review, liking it to Douglas Sirk's Imitation of Life. So we're bringing in both that movie and Henderson himself for the discussion.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Persona, Last Night in Soho, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days, Genevieve Kosky?
I am the TV editor at Vulture.com, and you can find me occasionally on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Tasha?
I have an exciting new title. I am the film and streaming editor at Polygon.com. We have hired a TV editor who's going to take some of the load off my back and my mind. I'm looking forward to this.
The idea of separating streaming and TV is just like blowing my mind right now.
Well, I'll tell you where it's already come up is the new Aardman animation is going to be on Netflix later this month, the month of November. It's called Robin Robin. They're presenting it as a special, to which I ask, does it make sense to call things a special anymore when it's not something that is interrupting the normal flow of television for a one-off, one-night event, and it's just thing being dropped onto streaming? It's not a movie. It's not TV. What is it? Oh, we don't know. It's streaming. I think we're going to have a lot more stuff in that vein. Just the sort of sense of Netflix keeps bragging about how its TV doesn't need to be any particular length. Its episodes don't have to be cut to any standard. We tell the story however long it takes to tell the story. So as much as we snipe at each other here about TV versus film and which is better, I'm looking at you, Scott.
Film.
There are certain things that, I don't know. It's just streaming. Forget about it, Jake. It's just streaming.
Can people find you on Twitter, Tasha?
People can find me on Twitter, but the point I was going to make before my fancy flashy new title got called out was that having Zosia Millman come in as our TV editor has given me more time to write. So you can actually find me writing about film again at polygon.com, including interviewing Edgar Wright multiple times about Last Night in Soho. And you can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. Keith, what about you?
I'm a freelance writer. I write for a bunch of different places like GQ and Vulture and The Ringer. You can follow my writing for those organizations for my Twitter account on twitter.com, which is kphipps3000. And with Scott Tobias, I'm a proud co-author of a newsletter called The Reveal. You can find it at thereveal.substack.com. If you'd like to hear Scott and me weigh in on the movies of the day and the movies of yesteryear and whatever, that's it's a pretty good source for that kind of thing, right? Right, Scott?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not telling you to smash the subscribe button or anything.
You've got to sign up for the free email
first and just see if it's the type of content you want to support and then smash it.
Yeah, when you decide to commit to a paid subscription, you got to smash it.
Yeah, that's all you have to.
As long as my beloved Smash isn't here somewhere, I'm good.
Absolutely. So obviously The Reveal is taking quite a bit of my energy and passion these days, but I'm also doing quite a bit of writing still for the New York Times, for Vulture, and for Guardian, among other outlets. You can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net and via Twitter at nextpicturepod. You can also contribute to our Patreon and get bonus content at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. If you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. And please also consider rating and reviewing us, which will help others find your favorite movie podcast, The Next Picture Show. Thanks to Dan the Bake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.
If you should find you miss a sweet and tender love we used to share, just come back to the places where we used to go, and I'll be there. Oh, how can I forget you? When there is